Would you turn in your Bible with me to Deuteronomy chapter 6, and let's read together verses 1 through 9. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 1 through 9. Now this is the commandment, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you're going over to possess it, so that you and your son and your grandson might fear the Lord your God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you, in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk with them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And all of us are familiar with the text in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4 that teaches fathers not to exasperate their children, but to bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. One of the most magnificent responsibilities that we have as human beings is the training of our children and our grandchildren. As I look out over this group, many of you I recognize have grandchildren, perhaps even great-grandchildren. Some of you have children that you're concerned about. And what I want you to realize is that when we look at these texts of scriptures, there's a great deal of importance given to the responsibility that we have of training them. We're going to talk a little bit more about that later in this series of studies. But this morning I want to talk with you about executing these various principles that we have already introduced in the two previous studies. And so I'd like to kind of review this chart with you for just a moment. We've talked about how that God establishes and maintains His relationship with us on the basis of His unconditional covenant commitment. And we've used illustrations of that, primarily, of course, the fact that He has sacrificed His Son for the forgiveness of our sins. We've talked about how that He mixes this unconditional covenant with His graciousness. He is flexible with us, recognizing that we're sinners and He responds to our circumstance and then uses His power to empower us. And as a result of that, we're drawn into a relationship with Him. And we've used this as the model for our relationships in marriage, and now we're going to talk about it particularly with regard to our relationships as parents and grandparents with our children. What we need to do is to manifest these same principles, because God is described in Scripture not only as the husband of His people, but He's also described as the father of His people, and thus we are the children of God. His relationship with us is the model that we need to ascribe and look toward to discipline ourselves in our relationship with our children and our grandchildren. And this concept of this unconditional covenant commitment is really important when it comes to our relationship with our children. Because what we're looking at here is we're talking about the fact that as parents we have a responsibility to be loyal to these children. Now let me kind of look behind that with you for just a moment on the basis of what we talked about yesterday. Loyalty to your children involves loyalty to their mother or their father. You say, well, why would you say that? It's because that this loyalty to your spouse provides this secure kind of environment in which these children can thrive. Your relationship, you might say, is the dirt in which these little plants receive their nutrition and learn and proceed through life. And if that relationship between the husband and wife is of poor quality or it is disturbed, these little plants are affected by it in drastic and significant ways. So recognize, as we've talked before, that your marriage is the primary relationship in this family, and so you need to cultivate it, you need to work on it, you need to give time to it first, and then to the children. Recognizing that this parent-child relationship grows out of this couple relationship. Now, having said that, I want to focus attention for you for just a moment on the goal of our parenting. I think probably all of us as parents recognize that we have as our goal to empower our children to maturity. In other words, what we'd like to see in our children is we want them to become self-disciplined adults. We want them to be spiritually mature. We'd like to have them to be devoted to God. As a matter of fact, many of us might say it like this. Well, what I want to do as a parent is I want to train my children so that they can go to heaven. Well, that's a noble goal, but I'd like to suggest to you that our goals are really more than that. We want our children not just to go to heaven. We want them to be spiritually mature. We want them to be devoted to God. We even want our children to be contributors to society. And we want our children to be leaders among God's people. But what we fear is that they will become involved in alcohol abuse. That they will become involved in illegal drug use. Promiscuous sexual activity. That they'll become hostile to us as their parents. And that they will exhibit all kinds of antisocial behaviors like stealing and lying and fighting and vandalism and that kind of thing. That's our fear. And how we use our parental power affects the accomplishment of our goals. And I want to talk with you particularly about that this morning. Because we have such noble goals. We're not just interested in them making it to heaven. We want them to be contributors and powerful contributors in the Lord's church, in the community in which they live, and in their own families. What we would want to do on the basis of these texts that we've read here in Deuteronomy chapter 6 is we would like to see our children be able to transfer their faith to our grandchildren and to their grandchildren. And what we're looking for is this intergenerational transfer of the faith. That is the ultimate objective that we have. Because we want not only good things for our children, we want good things for our grandchildren, we want good things for our family from here on. And we need to be investing in that big time. Well, this idea of empowerment, using our strength to help our children to be what the Lord wants them to be and what we want them to be, is absolutely critical in the accomplishment of this. I'd like to call to your attention a study that was done back in the 60s and 70s. It's actually become a classical kind of study, and it is still noted today among research scientists. Diana Bumrind published some research that she'd done as she investigated parents and what she described as their parenting style. There was another book that followed up on that back in the mid-80s by Merton and Irene Stroman. It was entitled Five Cries of Parents. And what they did is they elaborated practically on the implications of these three different styles of parenting that she was able to distinguish. Now, she distinguished between the three, what she described as three styles of parenting. Others have come along and kind of elaborated on these, but I want you to look at this study particularly with me. She defined the first style of parenting as autocratic or authoritarian. And we're going to try to define these in just a moment. And the terms are very similar sounding, at least in two of the categories. So you're going to have to be careful here to distinguish these. Autocratic or authoritarian parenting. And then she talked about permissive parenting. And finally, she talked about authoritative parenting. She described autocratic or authoritarian parenting like this. She said, with authoritarian parents, the parent values obedience as a virtue and favors punitive or forceful methods to curb the self-will of the child. She said, these authoritarian parents do not encourage give and take, believing that the child should always accept the parent's position as right. She elaborated further. She said, this style of parenting may be either very protective or very neglectful. She said, these parents tend to be more rigid, controlling, and demanding than other parents. And she said, when it comes to verbal give and take, the autocratic parent tends to stifle communication by always believing that they are right. In other words, they're not willing to listen to the children at all. She said, they tend toward over-control and expect the child to act as an adult. I don't know if you're like I am, but I like to read the funny page. And I particularly enjoy Beetle Bailey. And the relationship in Beetle Bailey that I particularly appreciate is the relationship that he has with Sarge. And in reading Beetle Bailey once, I came across just exactly what I believe this autocratic or authoritarian style of parenting is might be illustrated with Sarge. What transpired was Sarge barked out some orders to Beetle, and Beetle went on about his business. And then in the last frame, what's happened is Sarge has come on the scene, and there is Beetle's mangled body. His arms are laying all out of position, evidencing that they're just completely broken off, both of them. His body is all twisted and deformed, and both of his legs are all deformed and that sort of thing. And the impression that you get from that is that Sarge always barks out these orders and he expects Beetle to follow through with it. And if he doesn't, Sarge comes down on him and just lets him have it, breaking him up into pieces. Well, that's the image that I think about when I think about this autocratic or authoritarian style of parenting. It's this staff sergeant kind of approach where the parent barks out the commands and issues ultimatums, and if the child doesn't respond like they expect or want them to, then the child is torn apart one way or another. So from this kind of position above the child, the autocratic kind of parent uses this power down approach on the child. Well, Bumrine distinguished a second kind of parenting style. She described this as the permissive approach. In this style, she said, the parent sees him or herself as a resource to be used as the child wishes, not as one responsible for shaping the child's future behavior. She said this style of parenting is represented by the parent aiming to free the child from restraint and to allow the child to develop as he or she chooses. And this style believes that the child should have all the privileges of an adult. In other words, this is kind of the opposite of the authoritarian style. If the authoritarian style is controlling, this one is kind of hands-off. The third style of parenting that she was able to distinguish, she used the word authoritative to describe it. She said, with this style of parenting, there is a firmness of authority, but it is combined with a willingness to listen. That is, listen to the child. to have some kind of verbal give and take. She said this style of parenting exerts a firm control but doesn't hem the child in with restrictions while valuing the child's independence but expects a disciplined conformity. She says this style is represented by a balance between allowing children to make mistakes and to be their own person, and at the same time setting helpful protective boundaries and values for them. She says this style of parenting gives the child a chance to talk over the rules that they don't like or that they don't understand. She said this style of parenting is represented by parents that when they tell a child that punishment is due, these parents tend to follow through on it. Now, in light of the descriptions that we have given relative to power, I would describe this authoritative approach as represented by the power-up perspective that we've talked about from Matthew chapter 20. You recall that the disciples came to Jesus, the two disciples, James and John, saying, give us the chief places in the kingdom. He said, well, it's not going to be that way amongst my disciples. It's that way amongst the Gentiles, the people of the world. But in my kingdom, the greatest is going to be least, and the least greatest. He says, for the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. So the implication is that he takes his power as the Son of God and empowers from the bottom up his people. Now, the ideas that I see associated with the authoritative style of parenting, if I understand her description well enough, is that that's the perception that is associated with these authoritative parents. They take the power that they have, the authority that they have as parents, and they use it for the benefit and the development of self-discipline in this child. Well, now that's all well and good. Our question is, well, how do these different styles of parenting affect the behavior of the children? Well, that's just kind of where the rubber meets the road, is really what we're wanting to know. And so, the research indicated that for marijuana usage, that children that were raised in permissive style family relationships tended to have a higher usage of marijuana than the other two styles. The autocratic style of parenting, the children raised in that environment tended to have a medium use of marijuana, and those that were raised in authoritative parenting situations tended to have a lower use of marijuana. Now, from a practical standpoint, we say, well, I get this right off the bat here, that relative to drug use, it might be better to have this authoritative style, because the evidence is that if you are overly permissive or you're overly controlling, that there is greater chance that your children are going to use marijuana. Well, that's the reasonable expectation here. With both permissive and autocratic parenting styles, these children were judged to have lower self-esteem, evidence more aggressive behaviors, increased chemical usage, and a lack of interest in helping others. And you say, well, what's the big deal about helping others? Well, I think that you and I both know the answer to that. We're interested in training our children to be kind and compassionate, to use the powers that they have to encourage and build up other people and that sort of thing. We want them to be sensitive. And the research would suggest that the way to do that might be helped by the style of parenting that we use. Whereas the permissive style creates an atmosphere for misbehavior, the authoritarian style creates an atmosphere that emphasizes controlling behavior. To be honest, I want my children's behavior to be controlled. And to be honest, what I would like is I would like to have control of their behavior. But the fact of the matter is, I have to recognize that they're individuals too, and they have their own will. And I can't control everything. I can't control everything when they're not in my presence, for example. And really what I want as a parent, my goal is to help them learn to discipline themselves so that when they are even not in my presence, they exhibit qualities of being able to control themselves and discipline themselves in a good way. So authoritative discipline creates this atmosphere that seems to be conducive to a self-disciplined conscience. So that the goal is not just control of behavior, but a self-disciplined conscience. So that the child disciplines themselves. Now somebody says, well, you know, I'm getting the idea here that what we need to do is we need to be authoritative parents. Well, before you jump to that conclusion with both feet, let's back up and kind of evaluate this a little bit. Sometimes I think that really the key may be not just the style of parenting that we are using at a particular time in a child's life, but the level of flexibility that we allow ourselves and our child as they're developing. For example, as our child develops, we might move from one style almost into another. Permissive, to begin with. Moving to more autocratic kind of parenting later on. Then being more authoritative later on. And then as they're continuing to develop, maybe even permissive again. Now here's what I mean by that. When children are babies, parents tend to be more permissive. Now think about it. It's almost a have-to case. I mean, when they cry, you respond to it. You're kind of living for them. If their diaper is dirty, you respond to it. They're pretty much in control. If they're sick, you take them to the doctor, what have you. And when children get a little older, but they're still unable to reason well or logically, parents tend to be more autocratic. Let me give you an example of that. If you've got a two-year-old or younger that hasn't been around, let's say, a wood stove, and you go to visit the neighbors and they've got a wood stove and here your two-year-old there is there playing, what do? You tell them you don't touch that stove. You see how demanding that is and how controlling it is. It comes across with this powerful authority. Do not touch that stove. Well, you understand the reason why you're saying that. You want to be compassionate. You don't want them to get burned. But a two-year-old who's never been around a wood stove doesn't know about that. And so you exercise this intense level of control in that kind of a situation. Well, but then children continue to develop. They develop the ability to reason more effectively. And I think as parents, we probably need to shift gears into what I'm going to describe in her language as a more authoritative role. Let's say that we've got a 16-year-old and it's wintertime and my 16-year-old enjoyed having freedom to go where they please and have access to an automobile and that kind of thing. But you might say to this 16-year-old, you'll not be able to use the car tonight. Well, that may make them unhappy, But your explanation is the weather conditions are not suitable for an inexperienced driver. Now, there may be some conversation that goes on about that. This person has never driven on slick highways before, and the weather conditions are deteriorating and that kind of thing. They don't understand that, and you're here in the process of trying to help them to comprehend what the situation is. But now I want you to recognize that you still have authority in that who has ultimate control of the automobile. The parent does. Now, I'm going to reveal my stance here a little bit. I think it is not the best judgment, say it that way, for parents to freely give access to an automobile without exercising some parental control in that. Because I don't think that that 16-year-old is ready to handle that level of responsibility. At least mine weren't, I'll say it that way. And what we do, sometimes, some parents I have seen, their idea is, well, when my child turns 16, I'm going to go out and buy them this new Camaro and that kind of thing. And they give them access to this 400-horsepower engine. Ladies and gentlemen, my judgment is this is not a good thing. To turn the keys over to a 400-horsepower Camaro to a 16-year-old boy or girl, for that matter, probably not a healthy situation. It allows too much freedom. Do they need to go places? Yes, they do. But there needs to be some discipline in that. So I guess I'd have to say that I'm an authoritative parent in that kind of situation. Because our objective as parents is to help our children develop into self-disciplined adults. Now, since we're using that automobile illustration, and since I have two boys, let me tell you where I am now as a parent. My youngest son is 32. My oldest is 34. My oldest son just bought a new automobile. Guess what? Before he made the purchase, he felt like that he needed to talk to me about it. Not much, but a little. Now, why is that? Well, I think it's because of the relationship that we have. It's not because I'm especially adept at knowing a whole lot about automobiles and that sort of thing. But what he's doing now is he is approaching me from a different perspective than he was when he was 16. And that means that I've got to approach my relationship with him from a different perspective. And I'd have to say that even though he is coming to me and saying, well, what about this? Or talk me out of buying this, or give me all the negatives here, or what have you. That what he's doing is he's recognizing and he's showing respect to our relationship of the past and the authoritative style that he perceives between us. But now, basically, I am a permissive parent. You see, I don't have any control at all over what car he buys, or if he buys one. I have some level of influence, obviously, or he wouldn't be calling me or sending me a text message and saying, what about this? He's interested in my influence. Now, here is the deal, ladies and gentlemen. As parents, we recognize that our children, as they become older, they reach 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 years old, that they're developing into an adult. The signs that they exhibit in some circumstances are markedly adult signs. There are things that they do, and you kind of scratch your head and you say, well, I can't believe that my son made such a mature judgment. Or my daughter, look what she did here. And you're just plastered against the wall with the good judgment that they've used. And then tomorrow, they use such poor judgment that you kind of hold your head and you say, I can't believe that they did that. This just doesn't make sense. I thought they knew better than that. Well, that's the way it is in this developmental process. And the level of immaturity and that sort of thing. And as parents, what we see from our mature perspective is that this teenager exhibits marked signs of maturity in some instances, but gross immaturity in other situations. And what we want to do as parents is we want to control it all. We want to control it all. And then what we try to do is we try to become this authoritarian, controlling all of their thoughts and all of their actions because of their immaturity. And you know what they do? They push away. Push away. And this is part of the natural process. Now, here I think is what we as parents need to learn to do. Is we need to learn to model ourselves after the God of heaven, unconditionally committed to this child, dealing with them with gracious flexibility, working to empower them and give them some level of structure. But we have to understand that there comes a time in this child's life when we as parents are no longer under control of this person. And we need to kind of shift gears, recognizing that if we've done our job well up to this point, we still have influence, although we don't have as much control as we used to. Are you with me? Now, here's what parents ask me when I say that to them sometimes. Well, how do I know when and how much of this that I'm supposed to do? That's a good question. All right? I would suggest to you that it all depends on the child, and it depends on the attitude of the child, it depends on the maturity level of the child, and it also depends on you. The description I use in this is it's like we parents have this child that's walking on the edge of a razor blade. And what we're trying to do is to give them enough influence or control so that they're balanced up there, but not so much control that we push them off to the side as a result of them pushing against us. So it's a challenge to know when, how far, how much. Sometimes, personally, I feel like that I was too controlling. And I think I see evidence in my children's lives of that. And I'm going to say something else here from experience and talking with other parents. I talk with parents all the time about their relationship with their children, and some parents are really going through tough times. And it's like some parents haven't thought through all of these kinds of things, and they struggle. And the fact of the matter is that some of them have really difficult children, and they struggle with these kinds of concepts. And it's a challenge to you be able to use this wisdom at just the right time, just the right place. But you are the one that has this special relationship with this child, and you know them better than anyone else. And so these judgments are kind of in your court. You have to be cautious with it. You don't want to push too hard, but you want to provide the level of structure that is important. So, our objective is to raise these disciplined children. But sometimes what we do, instead of looking at the biblical model, is we kind of fall back on the model that we experienced as children. We have watched our parents, and so we fall back on that model a lot. What I'd like to challenge you to do is to keep looking to God as the Father here. I'd like for you to think with me about the story of the prodigal. Now, of course, in that account, you've got this father that has these two sons, and the younger one says, "Give me the share of the estate that falls to me." Now, the father obviously has control in that situation. He has authority in that situation, or the son wouldn't be coming to him and asking for his share of the estate. But I want you to notice what this father does. Now, my suggestion to you is that this father knows this son, has a real clear perception, in all likelihood, of what this son's going to do if he follows through by giving him his share of the estate. Of course, in this parable, the father represents God. What does he do? He gives it to him. Now think about that. He gives him his share of the estate, knowing all the while, I think, what this son's going to do with it. That's the model that God has set for us. At this level of understanding, this father opens his hand to the son and gives him what the son is asking for and allows him to go away. Now, is that what the father wanted? Well, no. No. And it's evident in the parable because the father evidently is anxiously longing for this son to come back. You might say, well, you know, if I was in that situation, I would be praying for him the whole time he was gone. I'd be worried about him. I'd be trying to find out information about him. Probably. That's what you would do. And yet this father allows him to go. And this is representative of God's relationship to all of us, particularly in this case, the Gentiles, who go out and do worldly things. There is a sense in which we as parents learn to help our children by allowing them to accept responsibility themselves. I've had people call me up on the phone and say, "Did you allow your son to do this or that?" Well, it happened to be a situation where he was doing something that I didn't prefer that he do. I would have preferred he would have done something differently, but it wasn't a situation where that was threatening his life or anything of that nature, and so I suppose there is a sense in which I allowed him to do it against what I would have done in the situation and what I preferred that he do. But I allowed him that freedom, because if I had become restrictive and controlling at that level, my son would have rebelled more than he did. All right? So it takes a lot of caution and sensitivity in this kind of situation. But what I want you to understand is that parents tend, as their children become teenagers, to not let go. Hold on to the rope, yes, but give it some slack. Our tendency is, when this child has more control, to tighten up rather than to allow some slack here. It's okay to have a rope on this child. You need to have some level of influence for sure. But when they're going in their own direction and you tighten up on it and you tighten up on it and you tighten up on it and you keep restricting them, what they're going to do in all likelihood is pull harder away from you. That's not what you want. That's not what you want. Now, in this parable, we learn a variety of things. Number one, that God is concerned about His people. In this particular parable, this son, when he comes to request his share of the estate while his father is still alive, Now think about that for a moment. I don't know of any society, unless the father willingly comes and says, I'm going to share my estate with my sons, I don't know of any society where sons are privileged to come to their father and say, okay, I want my share now. That's an insult to the father. And in this particular instance, it's in effect saying, I wish you were dead so I could have what I want. You see? But God cared for this son, cared for the other son as well. And so what I'm suggesting to you is that he is unconditionally committed to both of these sons. Even though this son is rebellious, prodigal. And I want to suggest to you that God responds to the needs of His children. It's evident in the scheme of redemption throughout the Scripture, culminating in the sacrifice of Christ. God is concerned about us as children. Now, I'd like to suggest something else to you. There is an account in the Gospels of Matthew chapter 3 and Mark chapter 1 where Jesus is baptized. You will recall it well. And a voice from heaven says, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. I want to analyze that statement with you. First of all, God says, this is my Son. In this statement, God is identifying Jesus as His. Now that gives that child a sense of identity. We've talked about Jesus' temptation. We'll touch on that again tonight, I think. And how Satan comes to him and says, if you are the Son of God, well, you've already heard this statement. His Father has already established that I am owning you as mine. And thus this ownership gives a sense of identity. We own our children when we give them our name. We own them when we take financial responsibility. We own them when we give them our time. We own them when we honor their father or their mother. And we own them in just little simple instances like introducing them and saying, this is my son or my daughter. We own them. And by doing that, we're not only following the model that God has set for us in this text, but at the same time, we are teaching them that God owns His children as well. We're teaching them that He is their Creator, that He makes provision for them. And we pray, Our Father, and we teach our children to be thankful, and they understand this sense of identity, not only that we are their parent, but that God is parent. You know, several years ago, I was in a class, and a professor came in, and he drew this stick figure on the board. And on top of the stick figure that had this head, well, he drew these zigzag things on top of it. And across the top of the board, the very top, he put the term God. And then down under that, he wrote such things as qualities that God possesses. Holiness, justice, kindness, gentleness, graciousness, etc. And then he drew some arrows down from God to this series of character traits that he had listed. And then down below the character traits he listed the opposites of those. Unholiness. Unfairness. Hatred. Ungraciousness. Etc. And then he said, here is the problem that we have in communicating the message of the gospel to people. See, he says, what we're trying to do is we're trying to communicate God to people. This is who God is. And what people do is they filter their perception of God through their relationships with other people who are not what God is. When God is holy, they are unholy. When God is gracious, they are ungracious. When God is loving, people ignore them. He said, what we do as human beings is we filter our perception of God through our relationships with the people that are around us. And he said, these little zigzag marks that I've got on top of this fellow's head here represent damaged love perceptors. These are the antenna that people have that are up there, and they're trying to get this information in, and God is trying to communicate it to them, but then their love receptors are damaged. Their antennae are damaged by their relationships with other people. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, let us not, as parents, be those that damage our children so that they cannot perceive of God correctly. Or that they have that kind of deficit. Oh, we're going to do enough damage, all right, inevitably because of our sin. But let's work in every way that we can to minimize that so that they can perceive God for who He really is rather than just seeing God through us. We had a tradition when our children were little of in the evening reading a book and praying with them and talking with them about their day. Very positive kind of thing for us. When our son Daniel was just little, he frightened the life out of me. Because every time as we would read a book and we talk about his day a little bit and then we would pray. This time I asked him if he wanted to lead the prayer. Well, he's just big enough to begin to talk and that kind of thing. About 2.5, 3 years old. And when he prayed, I realized what he had done in his language was that he had gotten me confused with God, which told me something. He's seeing me as God to him. Now, what a responsibility. And that's what this professor is trying to get across to us, isn't it? And we sing a song that reflects on that same kind of thing. We are the world's Bible. Okay. Well, in our relationship with our children, let's do everything that we can to communicate God to them, giving them a sense of identity, just like God does in this text. This is my son. But that's not all he said. He said, this is my beloved son. I'd like to suggest that that gives that child a sense of security. And we need to communicate that to our children. And it's okay to do it openly. Somebody says, well, how do you do that? Well, you do it through what you say. You do it through what you do. You do it through touching that child. All kinds of mechanisms that we use to communicate that we love this child. My dad, as I've mentioned to you, was born in 1901. Evidently, in his family, hugging was not something that very many people did. Or at least not from him. Now, I knew that my dad loved me. Okay? But I don't recall all this hugging and that kind of thing that a lot of times you see in other families. When Phyllis and I started dating, she was from a family where they hugged everybody. When I brought her home, guess what? She came around to hug my dad. Well, this is unusual for him. If you hug my dad, he stood there, stiff like this. You might as well go around there and hug the porch post. It was that stiff. Okay? When I tried to hug him, it was that way. But she came on the scene, started this whole thing of hugging him. You know what I saw happen? That finally, when after we got married and we would come home, he would stand out on the carport and wait for his hug. Wait for his hug. And he even came to the point that while he was standing there, he would put his hands up on your back and pat your back like this. Ladies and gentlemen, we all need this kind of communication. We're human beings. Children need that. Now, don't rush out and pick on this 18-year-old boy and say, I haven't hugged you before and now I'm going to start. He's going to be surprised by that and taken aback. So, work it in easy. But communicate that this child is the beloved. It gives that child a sense of security. It is out of this sense of identity and security that Jesus, in John chapter 13, is able to wash the disciples' feet. You know, that's a humbling kind of thing. But I want you to notice something. As John gives the paragraph leading into this episode, he said, Jesus, knowing from where he had come and where he was going, arose from the table and took the towel and began to wash the disciples' feet. Knowing what? Where he came from and where he was going. A sense of identity and a sense of security allowed for humbly serving other people. That's what we're looking for, isn't it? And God says, with this one I am well pleased. We need to communicate that to our children. Jesus has this very powerful sense of self-worth. Recognition of the fact that he is worth so much that he can lay down his life for the men. That's what we want. Following the model that God has set for us. Hebrews chapter 12, of course, talks about God's disciplining us through instruction and rebuke and all of that kind of thing. We recognize from Psalm 103 that as a father, he does not treat us as we deserve to be treated, but he is kind and compassionate and treats us as a father does his children. He forgives. And he allows us to know him. And he exposes himself to us. That's what the scripture is about. God revealing himself to us. Somebody said, well, here's the list of rules of the do's and the don'ts in scripture. Well, really what this is God's revelation of his nature and who he is to us. He's being open with us, and it creates this intimacy that we're looking for as human beings, as those designed in his image. And I'm suggesting to you as parents and grandparents, it's okay to be open with your children. The fact of the matter is you're not always right. And you may have to apologize for things that you've done wrong. And that's okay. That's okay. Your children need to learn how to forgive when you've goofed up. And you need to extend the same thing to them. Openness. Communication. Our time is exhausted and we're going to quit. There's all kinds of things that we could talk about here relative to this, but this will kind of get you started. And I want you to understand that this is not just about your children. Somebody says, well, my children are 50 years old. Yeah. I'll tell you something. You apply these principles to your 50-year-old children and watch what happens. Somebody says, well, my children are just young. Well, you apply these principles to those children and see what happens. Somebody says, well, my children are all gone. I've got grandchildren. So this text in Deuteronomy chapter 6 gives us grandparents' responsibilities. And we can apply these same principles to our grandchildren. Watch what happens. Watch what happens. We're not going to apply them perfectly, for sure. But these are our objectives and the plan that God has for us. And this is following what He's done. Thank you for your attention. If you have questions or comments, I'll be glad to.
You know, I raised 10 kids.
Wow.
And I went through everything. This is true.
And I can't begin to imagine raising 10 kids. I compliment you for that. I only raised 2. And the thing about raising 10 is I can only imagine the level of flexibility and the levels of differences between all these children. You know, sometimes you think as a parent, after you're raising, you're processing with one child, I think I got this figured out. And then the other one comes along and just blows all your theories completely out of the water. I remember a young couple in a congregation I used to preach with. They had a daughter. And this daughter, it was like that she anticipated what they were thinking and went and did it before they told her to. And so everything was going smoothly. All of the rest of us young parents were kind of shaken by the challenges that we were experiencing, and they were trying to tell us everything to do and that kind of thing. And then they had another child. He wasn't like she was at all. As a matter of fact, if they said do this, his idea was, no, I am not doing that. And so it was a challenge. And they learned, like the rest of us, that children are different.
I probably had to work a whole lot harder than you do.
Well, I don't know. You probably did to provide for all those and discipline all those children and their differences.
We always trusted in Jesus.
That's what
I think
we're talking
about.
That
was the biggest thing that led me through.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody else?
I remember being at a meeting in a place, and there was a little placard on the wall. And I kind of like placards. I kind of looked at them, and this placard in this fellow's house that said, I had 6 children, and I had 6 theories of how to raise them.
6 theories.
Now I've got no theories. and I always took away from that, and I tried to learn. Every one of your children is different. When you have girls, that's a challenge. I thought, I never had any sisters, and I ended up having 3 daughters. I didn't have any experience, nothing to draw on. But, you know, I didn't have the trouble with them that I had with the son.
Uh-huh.
And yet I have brothers, and yet that was a bigger challenge.
Uh-huh.
And they're just different.
Just different. And there are differences between males and females, for sure. But there are differences just across the board, no matter whether they're male or female. Yeah. Lots of flexibility demanded. Well, thank you for your attention this morning.